Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How close did Wall Street risk-taking bring the world to a second Great Depression? With the U.S. unemployment rate at a discouraging 10.2%, foreclosure rates of more than 300,000 homes a month, and the Dow Jones Industrial Average still nearly 3,800 points off its all-time high 2 years ago, many Americans are in dire financial straits right now. If there is anything more upsetting than the problems they're having, it might be the fact that, according to my guest, the crisis would not have been nearly as serious had Wall Street controlled its avarice and government regulators controlled Wall Street. Charles Gasparino is an on-air editor for CNBC. His new book is called The Sellout: How 3 decades of Wall Street Greed and Government Mismanagement Destroyed the Global Financial System. He's in town for a signing event tonight at the Barnes & Noble at Lincoln Park in Dallas that takes place at 7:30. Charlie, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
You know, your title suggests that there were people with great principles on Wall Street at one time.
But one or two.
Reading the book, they're few and far between.
Yeah. You know, I've been covering Wall Street for a long time, and you know, you don't want to make blanket statements about people that they're all bad. But there is something about the culture of Wall Street that does attract a certain personality that breeds arrogance and a certain risk-taking mentality that goes along with that arrogance. And you know, all you have to do is go into New York and hang out at a restaurant where some of these traders hang out at. And you'll understand what I'm talking about. They could be some of the most loathsome people in the world, loud, obnoxious. And, you know, that sort of type, you know, permeates up and down the ladder in terms of, if you see, my book is not just about the low-level traders, although they're in there because they're doing the trading, but it's about the CEOs and how they act. And I think that's the problem with Wall Street, is this sort of arrogance, ingrained arrogance, a sense of entitlement that developed, I think, over 30 years. And, you know, you ask yourself, why did this happen? Are these just, you know, greedy capitalists? And no, not really. I mean, it wasn't capitalism that caused them to be this way. Part of the way they got this way is because they were enabled. And the enabler was government. And that's what I try to show in this book.
Well, you know, when you talk about this culture, what's really striking here is that a lot of people seem to fear more for their jobs if they made prudent decisions and didn't risk too much than if they did things that they were well aware could crash and burn.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's kind of a perverse relationship. The people, there are heroes in this book. There's a guy named Pat Dunleavy, and he's not a household name. He was kind of a player at Salomon Brothers and worked at you know, the firms that Salomon transformed into. Remember, Salomon was bought by Travelers Group, which ultimately became part of Citigroup later on. And he worked there through the late 1990s. And he was a guy that I show in this book basically is constantly calling people to the carpet and worrying about the firm's reputation, worrying about how they handled clients, because he was worried about the excessive risk taking. And ultimately, he gets fired. And he gets fired, and he leaves the business, and he watches his what money he saved up over those years. He worked on Wall Street like something like 25 years, evaporate when the financial system imploded. And it's really kind of a sad story. Pat, there aren't enough Pat Dunleavys in the world. And what was interesting about Pat, and you know, I've known him for a while, and you know, he's a type of guy that understands. I mean, this is not a guy that doesn't understand that suggests that there should be no risk in the world. But he believes in a sort of risk-taking without the arrogance of it. And he believes that there are consequences to actions. And I think that's what this book is really about. If you look at the key players, the Dick Fold from Lehman Brothers, the guy that ran Lehman Brothers into the ground, Jimmy Cain, the guy who ran Bear Stearns into the ground, Stan O'Neill, the guy that blew up Merrill Lynch, forced it to be sold to Bank of America, and that sale nearly blew up Bank of America, as we're learning right now. If you look at those key players, and this book is largely about them, what set them apart from the low-level trader I mentioned before? Not that much, just that they were maybe a little more conniving to get to the top, but also they had some of that same arrogance that the low-level trader I talked to in the talked about in the restaurant has. And they had that arrogance because they believed in the end that, you know, they can do no wrong because they had some backup. And the backup was government. I mean, one of the things I try to show in this book is that, okay, we had a major implosion last year. However, we've had implosions in the bond, and much of this, you know, you hear about stock market crashes, bond market crashes are really what hurt Wall Street because the risk in bonds are so much greater. And you know, while average people may not invest in bonds that much, especially these esoteric things, these Wall Street firms sell them to sophisticated players, and the market is much bigger than the stock market and much more treacherous. So we had a bond market blow up in 2008 that destroyed the financial system, as everybody knows. But we had one in 1998. We had one in 1994. We had one in 1986. Each time the federal government came in with various bailout mechanisms, whether it was, you know, throwing money at it by putting interest rates down, bringing interest rates down to near zero, which was designed to liquefy the system, or as it occurred with long-term capital. Do you remember when that hedge fund blew up and everybody's worrying about the financial system in 1998? Well, the federal government came in and directly tried to bail out the system. And if you look at after each bailout, the risk, the amount of gambling that took place on Wall Street grew exponentially until it grew between 1998 and 2008 to a level that was unsustainable, where unless the government literally stepped in and began owning banks directly, taking over the financial system, we would have no financial system. And I'll tell you, not having a financial system, you know, as greedy as these guys are, you need them there to trade stocks and bonds. And you need, because everybody has their money in a 401k plan. You can't have the price of IBM go to zero where there's no trading. You can't have a situation where banks are not lending, which means you can't use your credit card. The economy comes to a halt. And they built up so much risk over the years that last year, this time, that scenario I just laid out where you have DEFCON 5, is that the number? Is that the worst? I don't even know. When you have, you know, a major implosion, we were almost there.
You know, Charlie, if we hadn't known what happened afterward, it would have seemed that the dot-com bubble burst and 9/11 that sort of shut things down would have been the ideal moment for everyone to step back and take a look at what had gone on. But then you had Greenspan coming in and instantly just gutting interest rates.
Well, that's what happened. I mean, I bring that up in the book. I mean, he took interest rates not lower than they are now. Now they're at such historic lows. And they're there because we have because of the financial crisis, obviously. But he took them down to like 1%. And we're talking about the Fed funds rate, which is the base rate, which all other rates are based on. And that rate really does control, you know, how much Wall Street can borrow and how much the banking system can borrow from each other. And when you took it down that low, well, you did a lot of crazy things to the economy. You inflated the financial sector to a degree that was unimaginable. You basically created money, gave people money. When banks have that type of cheap money, what do? They lend it. They lend it to people that may not be able to pay it back. And it just filtered through the system in basically through this thing called the mortgage-backed security, which, you know, it's interesting. If you look at the history of the blow-ups, this mortgage-backed security became the sort of vehicle for both risk-taking and the reason why they blew up. It's a fascinating thing because the mortgage-backed security was supposed to be something that was doing social good, right? A bank issues a mortgage to somebody. It takes that mortgage and sells it to Wall Street. You package it together. You sell it to another investor. By removing that mortgage, banks essentially frees up capital to lend more. Hence, you can have, you know, more loans to middle-class people. But it did kind of the perverse thing. It started to lend to so many people that housing prices were moving through the roof, that we've essentially priced out the working class and the middle class from housing by making it easier to borrow. It was a strange thing.
But mortgage securities had been done for some time and hadn't been a sure thing even in the beginning.
Never. I mean, never a sure thing, but never to the bubble proportions you had after 2001 when rates went down that far. But yeah, that's what the book talks about. The book basically says this blow up was one of many. It just got bigger and bigger every time because of the remedies that government took to deal with the blow-ups.
Well, let's talk about parallel to this. There was the Clinton administration really pushing for more and more
Absolutely.
Americans to become home buyers, to the extent that by the early 2000s, half of Freddie and Fannie's loans went to low and moderate income buyers.
That's not necessarily a bad thing. But I mean, here's the problem with all that. I mean, listen, I come from a family. I mean, and I'm sure that you have a lot of listeners that will say the same thing. Came from a working class family. My dad saved up to move us out of an apartment in the Bronx to move us into a house in Westchester County. He got a 30-year loan. He put down 20% on a $20,000 house. He could afford that. When you start doing what Fannie and Freddie was doing by essentially guaranteeing loans from people who aren't saving that 25%, that may be saving zero was what happened at the end. There was no down payments. You are putting loans. You are basically handing money to people who haven't really fulfilled their end of the bargain. There is a responsibility. You have to save a little bit for a house. You have to earn it. And not only that, by giving people money like that, they were inflating the housing market beyond the point where average people could afford a home without anything other than one of these crazy adjustable rate mortgages that are impossible to pay anyway. It really – and the book talks about how all this came together in this sort of time between 2007, 2008 where the system at that point couldn't handle it anymore. And I think that's the main point of the book, that bubbles are never created by one thing. You know, we can blame Alan Greenspan. You can blame greedy Wall Street investment bankers. You can blame the government. But really what this book tries to show you is that it's actually a confluence of factors that caused this thing. I believe the main factor, the driving force, was in fact government bailing people out of their decisions, creating false expectations for people. If you make $35,000 a year, I don't know how you believe you can own a $500,000 home. But there's an example of that in my book. And, you know, why was that expectation created? And I try to get at some of that we created a society where there essentially is no consequence, not for Main Street and not for Wall Street. And I think that's what we're sort of living through right now, the consequences of no consequences.
How are boards of directors not paying more attention to what their CEOs were doing?
Right. I mean, you know, that's the huge question. You know, it's fascinating because if you really want an example of a board, you know, we always think a board of directors like the watchdog, the internal watchdog for a company, right?
The checks and balances.
Yeah, you know, if you're the head of Citigroup, you're Chuck Prince or Sandy Weill before him, and you're taking excessive risk, you would think that the board of directors is saying, well, show me, you know, how much risk you're taking every day. You know what I'm saying? And what this book showed is that they didn't do that. And they basically clipped their coupon, whatever they make a year, $200,000 a year, and went home. And I showed that a lot through a guy who a lot of people know is Bob Rubin. Bob Rubin, one of the great Treasury secretaries of all time, takes a job with Citigroup back in 1999. And it's interesting how he got that job. I'll get into that later. But he takes his job with Citigroup in 1999 where he demands $15 million a year and no responsibility. And by the way, I want a board seat. And they gave it to him. And, you know, I know Bob Rubin pretty well because I interviewed him extensively for this book. He's a very nice man. But he's also a tragic guy because he, in a sense, sold out. That was what the book's about how you sell out your personal responsibility. As he was a senior executive at Citigroup, yet he advocated for risk and never monitored it. He would tell you that's not his job, but I would tell you that it should have been his job. He was a board member who basically believed that that he should farm out, you know, the sort of assessment of risk. I would say as a board, you know, let other people handle that. He didn't, you know, he wanted the cliff note version of how much risk the firm was taking.
We get the sense that he didn't really understand what he was getting into, which is remarkable given his background.
Understand or want to understand? Yeah. I don't know. And, you know, the book basically just gives you an idea of what he did and what he didn't do and his explanation for it. And I think he's one of the sort of, you know, I hasten to call him I don't want to call him a villain because he's a decent guy personally. But he is one of the reasons why we had this implosion. And by the way, I know he only worked at one bank, but he worked at maybe the most systemically important bank in the world, Citigroup, the biggest bank. When that thing unraveled last year, that's when you really knew that the financial markets were in bad shape.
Charles Gasparino is my guest. His new book is called The Sellout, How Three Decades of Wall Street Greed and Government Mismanagement Destroyed the Global Financial System. We'll take your calls in just a moment. You can get to us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can make your passion your career. Evening classes are now available in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is CNBC on-air editor Charles Gasparino. His new book is called The Sellout, How Three Decades of Wall Street Greed and Government Mismanagement Destroyed the Global Financial System. He's in town for a signing event tonight at 7:30 at the Barnes & Noble at Lincoln Park in Dallas. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. I think perhaps more upsetting to me, Charlie, than the people who were complicit in this is reading how many CEOs seem to not really know the deal. And you mentioned Jimmy Cain earlier. Can you talk about him at Bear Stearns?
He's like a fascinating figure. And the book opens up with him trying to hire somebody, you know, this a guy named Larry Freelander. It's in sometime in the mid to late 1980s where he says, listen, you're going to like working here, Larry. You know, we have an entrepreneurial culture, good people. You know, Bear Stearns was a historically Jewish firm where a lot of Jewish people who couldn't work at major firms like Morgan Stanley used to work at, because Wall Street used to be very segregated along ethnic lines. Morgan Stanley was for the WASPs. Merrill Lynch was for the Irish, working class Irish generally went there. They became stockbrokers. Goldman Sachs was for German Jews because it was founded by German Jews back in the 1800s. Bear Stearns was a place where if you were hungry and you couldn't get a job anyplace else, because of class kept out of Goldman Sachs and you're Jewish, you went to Bear Stearns. It's a fascinating thing. And so Jimmy Cain's telling him, says, you know, this is a firm, this is home for you. And, you know, you're going to like it here. And by the way, he whips out his drawer, bottom drawer of his desk, and he points down, I get the best pot in the city. And the guy looked at him and almost fell off his chair.
And this guy's like 70 years old.
Well, he's 70 now. He was 50 then. And he's, you know, there's a scene where I open with him. I open my book with him in the prologue about how he's basically fighting for survival of the firm. And I talk about how well I knew the guy and how once I was in an elevator with him and he this is like when he was in his 70s, he tried to hand me what looked like a joint. I did not take it and I did not smoke it with him. And so, you know, he's a very colorful character. But the question is, while he was, you know, doing this sort of stuff, you know, engaging in recreational, you know, allegedly engaging in pot smoking. And I talk about how much bridge he plays and how much golf he's playing. You know, Rome was burning, and you got to ask yourself, why did he develop that type of arrogance to be wasting his time doing that while the firm was in desperate shape? And, you know, some of this is, I believe, the fact that these guys never thought the end was ever really near, even when it was becoming increasingly clear that it was near.
And he underestimated by like half the amount of toxic assets at Bear Stearns.
More than that. Yeah, I mean, it was really bad. And not only that, it's not just the amount of assets they had. It's the amount of leverage. It's something called leverage. It's like if you borrow, you know, a lot, they borrowed 30 times more than they had in cash, and then you buy toxic assets. Think about the amount of risk you're adding to the bottom line. It's like it's like, you know, you have an adjustable rate mortgage, right? You put no money down as an average person. But also you got all these other credit card bills over here. And by the way, you might have a job or you might not have a job. And then think about how close you are to bankruptcy. And that's kind of what was going on at Bear Stearns and all these firms.
Yeah, and Bear Stearns and Lehman, they'd been at 30-1 since the 90s.
Yeah.
So it worked until it didn't.
Even more than that. You know, those when I say 31, it's borrowing 30 times more than you have in cash. You know, that those are end of quarter statistics. If you looked at it in the middle of the quarter, sometimes it was like 50-1, 100-1, and then they narrowed it down at the end of the quarter. So the regulator saw like a rosier scenario. But what they did was, yes, they were highly leveraged since the 1990s. Basically, they all became leveraged when they started becoming public companies. So they were gambling with other people's money. But what was interesting is they became more leveraged with more risky securities as the years go on. After each and every one of those bailouts, as I describe in the book, they start leveraging up with increasingly more risky securities. I mean, it's kind of a perverse thing. You would think they might learn their lesson after 94, definitely learned their lesson after 1998. But that's not the way human nature works. Human nature works in a perverse way where if you are bailed out of something, if you feel that you're going to be bailed out again, you will take increasingly more risk. You know, it's just the way human nature works. It's called moral hazard. That's what was established by all those other bailouts.
Well, I want to ask you about that because you've suggested that we put, you know, there's almost no way around the current bailouts, but that we put a moratorium on anything in the future.
Right.
Do you think, given what's happened and given the huge amounts of really just careless risk that was taken on, that Wall Street would believe, whether it's President Obama or anybody else, when he says we're not going to do this again?
Well, it's one thing to say it. It's another thing to take steps to end it. I mean, what's fascinating about what's in the news today is Goldman Sachs has given they say they're going to give $500 million to charity for small businesses for loans and education. And, you know, Warren Buffett, the great investor who's actually a big shareholder of Goldman right now, he was part of their bailout. He gave them money and capital. He's behind this effort. They're doing that because Goldman Sachs right now has amassed a bonus pool or is amassing a bonus pool of $20 billion. That's 1 year after they got bailed out. Now, how do they amass this bonus pool? Well, they amassed this bonus pool because the federal government, both the Bush administration and the Obama administration, believes that Goldman Sachs is what's known as a systemically important institution. We need them healthy to survive, so we have a financial system where people, you know, buy and sell stocks and bonds and, you know, trade stuff so pension funds don't close down. And there's a liquid market out there, so we need them. So we're considering them a systemically important institution. So we've now reclassified Goldman Sachs as a commercial bank, which means they can go to the Fed window and borrow from the Fed whenever they need it, which also means if they go into the open market and borrow to finance any of these trades that they do, well, they can borrow cheaply because creditors know that they are backed up by the Fed. So think about it. Goldman Sachs does not issue any loans. You can't get a credit card from them or a debit card. You can't, you know, open up a checking account there. Yet they are considered a commercial bank that is too big to fail. And because of that, that's essentially a taxpayer subsidy since they can borrow from the Fed. They're going out and borrowing very cheaply and trading on that. My point is this. You know, they're out. They should be out at this point. The umbilical cord should be cut where they're on their own. And, you know, it's almost disgusting to think that they're making all this money on a taxpayer subsidy 1 year after they were bailed out for taking risk. And they're going back to some of those same risk-taking practices with that subsidy. I mean, that's how crazy it is. So this whole thing about $500 million is such a joke in that context. And yet the Obama administration, just like the Bush administration, won't change their classification.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Charles Gasparino of CNBC, whose new book is called The Sellout. Let's go first to Keith in Irving. Hello, Keith.
Yeah, I was just wondering what your guest thought about the it seems to me it's been kind of played down, but the spike in energy prices of oil, which really began years before, energy climbing, oil in particular, triggered the beginning of this because it exposed so many of these mortgages, you know, people on the edge that once gas went up so high and food is also, they couldn't pay their mortgages, defaulting, and this whole thing became exposed, which, yes, looking back on it, is good that it was exposed then and not still happening now, you know, unknown to most of us, way getting worse.
Thanks for your call.
Interesting concept. I mean, yes, it wasn't just a spike in energy prices. It was a spike in interest rates. After keeping interest rates very low, you know, inflating, creating the bubble, I think it was Bernanke took over from Greenspan in late 2006, started raising interest rates. And that, in turn, started to deflate the bubble in such a massive way that you had the mortgage crisis began in earnest. And I mean, I think there's never one reason why something happens, you know what I'm saying? And you're right. Average people, you know, had a hard time paying their energy bills because they were so maxed out on their credit cards and their mortgage. And then what happened was when you raised interest rates, you know, a lot of these people were in adjustable rate mortgages. They got stuck with that. And then housing prices went down. So their equity in their home, if they had any, started to evaporate. And this is all what happened in late 2006 and early 2007. And the book talks about that. It goes through exactly what was happening to the average person and how that trickled down to Wall Street, which, you know, laid the groundwork for the financial crisis.
Is real estate undervalued right now?
Oh, God. Depends on where. You know, here's the problem that we have right now. We have unemployment at 10.2%. If it goes up to 10.5%, if it goes close to 11, you know, all bets are off in terms of we could have another banking crisis. And then, you know, then you don't know how high it could go. Then you, the train could come off the tracks a little bit here. And that's why getting a stimulus package that worked was so important. Now, hopefully it will work. Hopefully we stop at 10.5%, because what happens is when you get to 11, and this is according to the economists I talked to, consumers start defaulting on their loans. They start mortgage bonds that are still held by the banks that haven't been written to zero. Maybe they're written to 50 cents at a dollar. They start to fall in value because people start defaulting more on their mortgages. Consumers basically cause another banking crisis because those losses outweigh the gains the banks are making when they're trading, because that's how they're making money right now. They're borrowing at zero or next to zero and trading and investing in something. A treasury bond is what – a 10-year bond is what, 3%? I mean, that's essentially what they're doing. It's called a carry trade. That trade, they're making more money from that trade than they're losing on their consumer debt, their consumer loans, on commercial real estate bonds that they hold. But however, if unemployment starts ratcheting close to 11
– then they can't hold out.
It looks like they're going to need more capital. And where's Citigroup going to get more capital? Maybe they can raise it. Maybe they're a $4 stock. And then you start seeing where the banking system starts to seize up a little more. It's not just that they need more capital, because I think the government will give it to them. They won't lend anymore. I mean, they're barely not lending now. Forget about lending anymore when that starts happening, because they have to hoard cash to hoard capital. And that's when you could see this start really filtering through the economy in a very bad way. Now, that's the doomsday scenario. There are people who believe, smart people like Jim Grant of Grant's Interest Rate Observer, you know, a notorious bear, guy that was always negative. He thinks we're going to have a V-shaped recovery. He thinks that interest rates are so low, businesses have pared inventories. The economy is poised for a massive recovery. That V means you go down sharply, then you go up right. sharply, and that's what he believes, and he probably also believes that we have a greater chance of inciting inflation with all this free money. But those are the two things. I mean, I see sort of merit in both arguments. I'm more worried about the double dip recession, because for some reason this stimulus plan has not worked. No matter how many times they tell you, well, you know, it would have been a lot worse. You know, all their projections. The White House projected if you spend $800 billion, unemployment would have stopped at 8.5%. Now, obviously, it didn't do that. It's now close to 10.5%. And I'll tell you, that means that – just think about it. That means you spent $800 billion for nothing. When you spend $800 billion, you have to issue debt to spend that money. You're going to get higher interest rates later on because of that debt. That will sort of squeeze economic growth in of itself. And that's the problem that we face. We have a stimulus package that didn't work and could make things worse.
Well, you call yourself an economic libertarian, but you do recognize that there's a role, especially in a crisis of this magnitude,
absolutely,
for the government to jump in. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the Depression and the fact that that was not at the outset. It didn't start in 1929 and continue for 10 years. There was a series of ups and downs, some of which had to do with a drawback of government assistance.
Well, you have to realize what happened, what incited, what made the – I mean, if you look at a stock market chart, this is why you can never judge the stock market as an indicator of the economy's overall health, because right before the you-know-what hit the fan in 2008, we were at a high. We were at 14,000, and people thought everything was going to be hunky-dory, and obviously it wasn't. If you look at a stock market chart during the Great Depression, there were lots of highs. You know, it looks like the market's recovered, and – you know, you wouldn't know by looking at the chart, just looking at the chart, that we were in a Great Depression. I believe there were policy mistakes at the outset of the Great Depression by the Hoover administration, and then doubled down by Roosevelt, that made what was, you know, an economic shock like we have today into something much worse. Hoover went out and basically raised taxes. He went out and cut off trade. You know, there was that Smoot-Hawley Act. So he did things to stifle the interest of deficit reduction. He did things that basically stifled any type of recovery that would occur, because you're taking money out of the system, pulling money out of people's hands. And if you're ever going to deficit spend, that's the time to deficit spend, right? It's not a time to worry about, you know, plugging the hole in the deficit when you have that type of economic calamity as we had in the 29 crash. And then Roosevelt, you know, basically tried to socialize the economy. He basically the New Deal was an effort more or less to supplant private enterprise with government. And it didn't work. I mean, and that's what I worry about this. I mean, listen, I'm an economic libertarian. There was also no atheists in a foxhole. When you see what happened last year, I mean, you had to act and act fast. However, I do worry about government imposing mandates right now on small businesses when they shouldn't be imposed. I mean, healthcare is a worthy debate. Small businesses are scared to death of it. They're scared to death of $1 trillion of taxes. And they're not hiring because of it, and they're worried about it. And listen, stimulus is good, but you know, you got to look at the history of spending, of government inciting stimulus. It hasn't been good. It hasn't worked very well. Not even pretty well. It's been disastrous, more or less. And I think that's the problem that we face right now. We're getting off track. When right now, you know, what we have to do desperately is get people back to work. And you don't get people back to work by promising to raise taxes in a year, which is what the administration and Congress wants to do. I mean, we're going to be moving the upper bracket back up again at the worst possible time.
Charles Gasparino is my guest. He's an on-air editor for CNBC. His new book is called The Sellout: How 3 decades of Wall Street Greed and Government Mismanagement Destroyed the Global Financial System. He's in town for a signing event tonight at the Barnes & Noble in Dallas at Lincoln Park that takes place at 7:30. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can send us an email. The address is think@kera.org. The phone number is 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can make your passion your career. Evening classes are now available in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. CNBC on-air editor Charles Gasparino is my guest. His new book is called The Sellout. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we find Tim in Dallas. Hello, Tim.
Hey there. I was playing golf with a couple of friends of mine last fall, right when things were really starting to plummet. And met up with a couple of guys on the tee box, and you know, of course, as the game goes on, we start talking about what we're doing. And the two guys that we were playing with were good friends, but they were also unemployed mortgage brokers. And we started talking about, you know, the whole situation that was happening and how clear everything was becoming very quickly. And you know, I started asking the guys the questions, and they were telling me about the fact that you could basically just walk into their office and you could sit down and say, this is how much money I make a year. You didn't have to provide any documentation whatsoever, and you could basically buy, within limits, of course, just about any house that you wanted. And, you know, the logic, you know, inside me just said, but you understood, obviously, how stupid that was and how that couldn't work. I mean, why would you continue doing that? And, of course, their answer was is if we didn't do it, they would go 3 blocks down the road, and there were 5 other businesses that would just be waiting in order to do that. So it kind of sparks in me the question in terms of regulation. You know, there's arguments on both sides between the idea of more and more deregulation versus more regulation. But in the end, how can we get to the point where we really feel like that we're able to regulate morality? Because these guys, on the one hand, aren't bad people. They're fathers, they're husbands. They're trying to put food on their table and keep a roof over their heads. But at the same time, they're not stupid people. They realize that what they're doing is, in essence, also taking advantage of people in a certain way.
I think we've got your point. Yeah, it's a great question. Thank you very much for calling.
That is a great question, because what you had here, you know, in bubbles, just so you know, in bubbles, sometimes economic sort of what they call irrational exuberance occurs, term used by the guy that caused this bubble, Alan Greenspan.
Americans are known for irrational exuberance fields.
Right. And so it's kind of like the fish don't know they're swimming in the ocean. You know, you don't realize what's happening as you're doing it. And I'm sure part of it was them saying, well, if we don't give this guy the loan, they'll go to the guy down the block. But also part of it was like, well, you know, housing prices are going up. You know, there's going to be – we're going to have immigration trends that show that, you know, there's going to be a need for more homes. That need will spark even more buying of homes. So housing prices, you know, long term are going to accelerate. They're not going to deflate. So remember, some of this was based on, you know, economic theory that within the context of a bubble looks sound. In 2020 hindsight, it looks insane, right? People with no value, putting nothing down, without any job sort of proof of working. There's a great scene in my book of how a mortgage investigator had to go out there and basically investigate, you know, what happened, why this guy couldn't pay his mortgage, and he found out that the guy wasn't lying, but the mortgage broker lied and said he made not $35,000 a year, but, you know, $70,000 a year. Said he worked as a computer programmer instead of what he was a hospital orderly. So there was a degree of fraud. But remember, you know, one of the interesting things about bubbles, and this is why I believe you're not going to see a lot of prosecutions coming out of this from Wall Street especially, is that bubbles induce just stupid behavior, you know, because there's a groupthink that goes on that if I don't buy this house, guess what? Someone else will. So I'm going to do whatever I can to buy it. Then you have banks saying, well, we believe that housing prices will keep going up. So if you buy it for $500,000, you put no money down, you'll be in a year from now, you'll be sitting in a house worth $600,000. So you can sell it. You know, if worse comes to worse, you could sell it and basically pay us back. And then that on top of the fact that you had the mortgage bond, which allowed banks to basically sell the responsibility of the loan to someone else. If I'm a bank and I lend you money and I could take that loan and sell it to someone else, well, I don't care if you're a deadbeat.
So there's no due diligence.
Well, it's less and less due diligence. You put all that together and that's what happens in bubbles. It's not necessarily fraud. The history of bubbles are interesting. Why did people buy Beanie Babies? It was like went through the roof, all right? Tulips in the 16th century. You know, what made a tulip worth so much? Baseball cards, you know, old baseball cards. I mean, what is the inherent value of a baseball card? Well, a lot of this is just groupthink and behavior and irrational exuberance. This is a little different because a house, you know, has inherent value. It's not like gold, but a house is a place to live. So the theory was, you know, when people keep buying them, if you have immigration trends a certain way, if the economy looks like it's sound, right, it's not going into the tank, interest rates are essentially stable. You know, the theory is that housing prices will continue to accelerate. So why should I make that loan? You're going to pay it back.
You suggest here that rather than for those criminal investigations that are appropriate, that we turn those over to the FBI instead of the SEC.
Yeah, everybody keeps asking me about this. I just think it's a failed organization. All you have to do is look at – I'm sorry, I'm losing my voice because what I've been doing is talking for the last 3 weeks. But
we're glad you're here.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here. Look at what happened with Bernie Madoff. Now, this should have been the easiest scam to catch. This guy touts that for 20 years, he's returned anywhere between 8 and 12% guaranteed.
Nobody has that kind of luck.
I don't know. Have you ever – Warren Buffett can't do that. How could Bernie Madoff? Yet people – by the way, this gets back to the whole concept of irrational exuberance. People keep giving him money, right? Normally smart people, you know, gave him money thinking that he had this ridiculous sort of system. It was called the split strike conversion strategy. I know people that were investigators, hedge fund investigators. They basically investigate people like Bernie Madoff to see for high powered clients to see if they should put their money in him. And they could never replicate his returns. They couldn't figure out how he got those returns. So the SEC calls him in. not once, not twice, like a half dozen times, brings him in and never checks the very simple fact of whether or not he actually ever did a trade. Now, his whole strategy was based on, you know, selling options and going into the market and rapid fire selling. Yet nobody in the options pits knew who he was. He left no trace. And the SEC never once said, okay, show me your trades. Show me the confirms so we can see if you actually did that trade.
Well, my understanding is, didn't he say, well, I've got him, I can bring him to you? And they were like, ah, we believe you.
That's it. Mm-hmm. Why do they believe him? I mean, and by the way, if you can't catch Bernie Madoff, because this wasn't a hard thing to catch. This guy, Markopoulos, an investor, went to them and just laid it out for him, you know, and said, here's why he's a crook. And it wasn't just him. I'm sure there were others. You know, you don't get caught in the web like eight times unless people are saying this guy's nuts. You would think somewhere along the lines, somebody would have said, let's just check if he ever did a trade. And they didn't. And I think if they can't catch Madoff, there's no way they were ever going to come close to catch the stuff that I have in my book. I mean, this is complicated stuff, and it takes more than just, you know, one call. I mean, basically what you had here, the risk that was being – and by the way, I'm not saying it's fraudulent, but this is what I'm saying about regulation. They took so much risk under the nose of regulators. Regulators, I don't believe, understood what 30-to-1 leverage is. The average person does, but these people at the SEC did not. They didn't understand what it meant to be leveraged with increasingly esoteric bonds. When I say leverage, the banks held these bonds on their books during good times to earn the interest income because they throw off a lot of interest, but they're very risky. So when they blow up big. Plus the fact that they were purchased with leverage, with borrowed money. And you put all that together, it could be a toxic stew. The SEC had no clue that was going on, even though it was their job to monitor that. The Fed had no clue what was going on at the banks either. But, you know, they at least did some monitoring. The SEC did absolutely no monitoring at Bear Stearns, at Lehman Brothers, which Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers was their primary regulator was the SEC. So I'm telling you, if they can't catch Bernie Madoff, there's no way they're going to catch this stuff.
Well, Charlie, give us a profile of the average SEC regulator, because my understanding is these are young guys who would really love to move over across the street and make 10 times what they're making right now.
Yeah, I mean, that's the problem. They want to work for Wall Street. There's an inherent conflict of interest that, you know, Bernie Madoff used to brag about how his niece, who was a compliance officer, is married to a guy who's in the SEC, who actually went on and started his own firm. I mean, that's what goes on here. I mean, there's a revolving door between the SEC and Wall Street, and it's so tight. It's kind of like the people working in Washington becoming lobbyists. Only the SEC is not supposed to be a lobbying firm. I mean, there's supposed to be an adversarial relationship right off the bat with Wall Street. You know, they're almost supposed to believe that these guys are guilty, I think. By the way, this is not a criminal. You know, the SEC can't put you in jail. They file civil charges. So a little adversarial relationship ain't a bad thing. But that wasn't what it was. It was like a friendship. It was a partnership. You know, it was explicitly a partnership. It's called self-regulation. Wall Street is self-regulated first by it used to be the NYSE, the New York Stock Exchange, and the NASD. They were members of those organizations. So they regulated themselves up front. And then the SEC was on top of all that, monitored the whole process. That's how perverse it was. It was not just that there was a conflict of interest with the SEC. There was even a greater conflict of interest with the entities, the New York Stock Exchange and the NASD, that provided what's known as frontline regulation. So it's easy to see how all this can happen. So my point is, you know, instead of fixing these agencies, which I believe are unfixable, get rid of them. Give it to the FBI. I mean, the FBI, for all its faults, I think does a better job. I think the investigators there are very professional. They understand their role is not to work in the securities industry, but to catch bad guys. And that's what I think they should do.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Francis in Granbury. Hi, Francis.
Hello. How are you?
Hi. Great. Thanks.
Quick question for Mr. Gasparino. What are his thoughts on current loans that are on the books with banks for commercial assets? Will this affect our economy in the future? I've heard a lot of theories that the economy won't close due to these loans that are on the books that the banks haven't written off yet, whereas a lot of the residential loans have always
think you're right. They've been written down, not written off. I mean, and that's the problem, that if unemployment doesn't stop growing, you're clearly going to have the residential loans and the residential mortgage-backed bonds that are written to 50% on the dollar, written down to 50 cents on the dollar, are going to be written down to 30. So you're going to get hit there, although they're mostly written down. The big sort of bang that if you believe in the nightmare scenario is on the consumer loans that are still there that haven't been written down, the credit card receivables, the automotive receivables, and yes, the commercial real estate stuff. And a lot of this is dependent on the economy and getting people back to work. And, you know, the more people work, the more you see office buildings filled up. And, you know, I believe that there's a 50-50 chance that those loans start defaulting at very high rates, and because unemployment, I think there's a very good chance it's gonna go up to 11%. But remember, there's two scenarios here. There's that doomsday scenario, and then there's the Jim Grant, Larry Kudlow scenario. Larry's one of my colleagues at CNBC who believe that the economy is gonna get better, and if it does get better, then I think we could escape, you know, a commercial real estate debacle. And we could escape another banking crisis because people, if once they're back to work, could pay back those loans, the credit cards and their car loans. I mean, those are the two scenarios. It depends on where you think unemployment's going. And by the way, I mean unemployment. I don't even mean recovery. I mean, you can literally have a jobless recovery. We have a jobless recovery as it is. I think there is positive GDP growth now. The question is, no one's hiring. So, I mean, we can have positive GDP growth and unemployment at 11%, and you could have problems in the banking system, and this economy could get dramatically worse.
We just have about a minute left, but I wonder what you think we ought to do in order to keep this from happening again in 20 years.
Well, I say in the book, we have to cut the umbilical cord. I mean, Goldman Sachs can no longer be a commercial bank. I mean, that's got to be done. I mean, they have their $20 billion in bonus money. They made it partially on the backs of taxpayers' subsidy. They got to be cut off. Same with Morgan Stanley. And then we have to at some point tell the Citibanks and the Bank of America that are real banks, right? You know, if you have to spin off your risk trading, your risk-taking activities. I mean, Glass-Steagall back in 1999 was a law that prevented banks from merging regular banking activities, lending and customer deposits, with the risk, with the trading operations. Bob Rubin went to work behind the scenes to get rid of Glass-Steagall. Then he went to work for the ultimate beneficiary of Glass-Steagall, which is Citigroup, which is now, you know, a government-owned bank. I think what we should do is tell Jamie Dimon, who runs J.P. Morgan Chase, the guys who run Citigroup, the guys who run B of A, you got to spin off your risk activities, or, you know, we're not there to save you.
Charles Gasparino is an on-air editor for CNBC. His new book is called The Sellout, How Three Decades of Wall Street Greed and Government Mismanagement Destroyed the Global Financial System. He will be signing books tonight at the Barnes & Noble at Lincoln Park in Dallas. Charlie, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
The Think Team includes assistant producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.